Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. January 15, 2017, New Varshana, Auckland, New Zealand. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 4, The Process of Creation, Text 8. Nunam Bhagavato Brahman Harir Adbhuta Karmana Durvidabhyam Iva Bhati Kabibis Chapi Chastitam. Please chant. Nunam, still insufficient. Bhagavataha, of the personality of Godhead. Brahman, O learned Brahmana. Harehe, of the Lord. Adbhuta, wonderful. Karmanaha, one who acts. Durvibhabhyam, inconceivable. Eva, like that. Abhati, appears. Kavibhi, even by the highly learned. Cha, also. Api, in spite of. Chestitam, being endeavored for. So this verse is in the context of Maharaj Purkhit asking Sukadeva Goswami to describe about the creation of the material world. Translation. O learned Brahmana, the transcendental activities of the Lord are all wonderful, and they appear inconceivable, because even great endeavors by many learned scholars have still proved insufficient for understanding them. This is a little bit more than a two-page purport. And there's something in this purport, and I didn't have time to do a thorough research. I don't believe that what is in this purport is in any other purport in Prabhupada's books anywhere, as far as I know, what we're going to find in this purport. If you can find another instance of it, I'd be very interested to know. So Srila Prabhupada does something very, very, very interesting in this purport, which he appears, after doing it in the purport, he appears to then contradict in the very last sentence of the purport. So he appears to contradict his own doing of it in the last sentence of the purport. So I'm not going to tell you what it is. I'm going to read through the purport and see if you can figure it out. Ready? Okay. Srila Prabhupada's purport. I'm not going to stop in the middle. I'm just going to read through it. The acts of the Supreme Lord in the creation of just this one universe appear inconceivably wonderful. And there are innumerable universes, and all of them aggregated together are known as the created material world. And this part of his creation is only a fractional portion of the complete creation. The material world stands as a part only, ekam sena stito jagat. Supposing that the material world is a display of one part of his energy, the remaining three parts consist of the Vaikuntha jagat, or spiritual world, described in the Bhagavad Gita as Madhama, or Sanatana Dhamma, or the eternal world. We have marked in the previous verse that he creates and again winds up the creation. This action is applicable only in the material world, because the other, greater part of his creation, namely the Vaikuntha world, is neither created nor annihilated. Otherwise, the Vaikuntha Dhamma would not have been called eternal. The Lord exists with Dhamma, his eternal name, quality, pastimes, entourage, and personality are all a display of his different energies and expansions. The Lord is called Anadi, or having no creator, and Adi, the origin of all. We think in our own imperfect way that the Lord is also created, but the Vedanta informs us that he is not created. Rather, everything else is created by him, Narayana Paro Vyaktat. Therefore, for the common man, these are all very wonderful matters for consideration. Even for great scholars, they are inconceivable. And thus such scholars present theories contradictory to one another. Even for the insignificant part of his creation, this particular universe, they have no complete information as to how far this limited space expands, or how many stars and planets are there, or the different conditions of those innumerable planets. Modern scientists have insufficient knowledge of all this. Some of them assert that there are 100 million planets scattered all over space. In a news release from Moscow, dated 2-21-60, the following piece of knowledge was relayed. Quote, Russia's well-known professor of astronomy, Boris Vorontsov-Velyaminov, said that there must be an infinite number of planets in the universe inhabited by beings endowed with reason. It could be that life similar to that on Earth flourishes on such planets. Doctor of Chemistry Nikolai Zirov, covering the problem of atmosphere on other planets, pointed out that the organism of a Martian, for instance, could very well adapt itself to normal existence with a low body temperature. He said that he felt that the gaseous composition of Martian atmosphere was quite suitable to sustain life of beings which have become adapted to it. Unquote. This adaptability of an organism to different varieties of planets is described in the Brahma Samhita as vibhuti bhinam, i.e., each and every one of the innumerable planets within the universe is endowed with a particular type of atmosphere, and the living beings there are more perfectly advanced in science and psychology because of a better atmosphere. Vibhuti means special powers, and bhinam means variegated. Scientists who are attempting to explore outer space and are trying to reach other planets by mechanical arrangements must know for certain that organisms adapted to the atmosphere of Earth cannot exist in the atmospheres of other planets, in parentheses, easy journey to other planets. One has to prepare himself, therefore, to be transferred to a different planet after being relieved of the present body, as is stated in the Bhagavad Gita 9.25, Yanti deva vrata devan, pitrin yantri pita vrataha, bhutani yanti bhutejya, yanti madhyani no pimam. Those who worship the demigods will take birth among the demigods. Those who worship ghosts and spirits will take birth among such beings. And those who worship me will live with me. Maharaj Prakrit's statement regarding the workings of the creative energy of the Lord discloses that he knew everything of the process of creation. Why then did he ask Sukadeva Goswami for such information? Maharaj Prakrit, being a great emperor, a descendant of the Pandavas, and a great devotee of Lord Krishna, was quite able to know considerably about the creation of the world, but that much knowledge was not sufficient. He said, therefore, that even greatly learned scholars failed to know about that. Even after great effort, the Lord is unlimited, and his activities are also unlimited. And his activities are also unfathomed. With a limited source of knowledge and with imperfect senses, any living being up to the standard of Brahmaji, the highest perfect living being within the universe, can never imagine knowing about the unlimited. We can know something of the unlimited when it is explained by the unlimited, as has been done by the Lord himself in the unique statements of the Bhagavad Gita. And it can also be known to some extent from realized souls like Sukadeva Goswami, who learned it from Vyasadeva, a disciple of Narada. And thus the perfect knowledge can descend by the chain of the siddhic succession only, and not by any form of experimental knowledge, old or modern. Nunam Bhagavato Brahman Hare Adbhuta Karmana Durvibhavyam Ivabhati Kavi Bhis Chapi Chaschitam. O learned Brahmana, the transcendental activities of the Lord are all wonderful, and they appear inconceivable because even great endeavors by many learned scholars have still proved insufficient for understanding them. So what did Srila Prabhupada do in this purport that, as far as I know, he has not done in any other purport? Yes. He quoted some Russian scientists in a purport. Anybody remember the date of the quote he was pulling from? 1960. Generally in academic circles, you try to avoid old quotes. And this was written at least 10 years later. So he has a quote from these Russian scientists. And then what does Srila Prabhupada say in the end of the purport? They can't understand anything. Well, it says insufficient. Insufficient. He doesn't say anything, which is important, that he doesn't say anything. He doesn't say they can't understand anything. In fact, Srila Prabhupada also says that not only are the material scientists, insufficient, experimental knowledge insufficient, what does he say is also insufficient? Even if you do what? You're still going to have insufficient knowledge. Yes, even transcendental knowledge coming from the Parampara, you can't know anything. And Prabhupada's saying, even the great realized souls don't know everything. Who's the only one who knows everything? And that's it. Nobody else is going to know everything. So I thought we would do a little bit different kind of class today. I thought we would do more of a East to Ghosty discussion kind of class today, because this was just so unusual. And there were so many things we could have talked about in this purport. Like Prabhupada talks about how we have to prepare ourselves in this life to have the right kind of body for our next life. So I thought that was a really interesting thing. And the way we prepare for our next body is who we worship and who we meditate on. So that was a really interesting thing. But I thought the most interesting thing in this purport was that Prabhupada quoted some Russian scientists in a purport. Jai Dvaita Maharaj, he writes in a section of the Vedabase about the levels of authority of Srila Prabhupada's statements. That Srila Prabhupada's statements in his purport have the highest level of authority because Srila Prabhupada was intending them to be used for thousands of years by millions of people in all different kinds of circumstance. Then the next would be the lectures, because the lectures are given according to time, place, and circumstance. And then next after that, he says, were the letters, because lectures are still public. So they're still for a wide audience, but letters are going to be not only time, place, and circumstance, but also for specific individuals, or sometimes groups of individuals. And he says the last is conversations, and the reason for that is that it's very hard to understand a conversation without being there. That a recorded conversation, you're losing a lot. Especially, Maharaj makes the point that we meander from one topic to another, and that many times our conversation is based upon some sort of clues in our environment or some kind of body language. So when we, especially in conversation, we tend to be sloppy with our language. So we'll use a lot of pronouns without antecedents. Do all you remember that from grammar class? Sorry if you hated grammar. But if you just say, he went to the store, who's he? In our conversations, we may say things like, that really annoys me. What's that? And sometimes you're talking about one thing, and then you see something, and you point to it and say, that is really bad. And somebody listening to a recording thinks that refers to the previous topic of the conversation, when actually it refers to something else. And we all have this kind of thing in our own conversations with people, right? Because they flow in there. So it's not so easy to figure out exactly what Srila Prabhupada meant from a recorded conversation. Plus they're also plus they're time, place, and circumstance. Plus they're individual. But here we have Srila Prabhupada in a purport. And he's saying, my books are going to be the law books. The books are the basis of the Krishna consciousness movement. Where he's quoting some Russian scientists from 1960. And in the very same purport, he's saying that such knowledge is insufficient. In fact, the verse says it's insufficient. So why is he doing this? Why is he quoting some Russian scientists from 1960? And I thought we could kind of examine what is the place of empirical knowledge. This is, of course, a big discussion in our Krishna consciousness movement, and the GBC has requested, so I have a personal reason for asking for a discussion on this, actually, as part of my own service. So many years ago, the GBC requested that there be a detailed paper written on what's called hermeneutics. So hermeneutics is related to the science of epistemology, and you don't have to remember any of these words if you don't want to, but for those of you who like such things, epistemology is how do I know what I know? And hermeneutics is how do I study sacred literature? What's my process for determining authority in sacred literature. So a committee was convened, made up of Bhakti Vikas Swami, Bhadranarayan Maharaj, who was not at that time Maharaj, representing one end of the spectrum, Hriday Nanda Maharaj representing another end of the spectrum, Radhika Raman Prabhu and Judah Karma Prabhu representing kind of a moderate position, and Vrajabihari Prabhu as facilitator. So they spent about 2 years or so putting together a paper and then going back and forth, meeting face-to-face and so forth. And at the end of that 2 years, some of the members dropped out. Bhadranarayan Maharaj first dropped out, and other people just said, I don't want to work on this anymore. So it remained unfinished. Hriday Nanda Maharaj published the unfinished paper. But anyway, it remained an unfinished paper that doesn't really represent the views of all the people involved because they hadn't finished it. So recently the GBC gave this assignment to the Shastric Advisory Council, which at the present moment I'm not quite sure why, but anyway, at the present moment I'm the acting chair of that committee. So we're supposed to take what they did and we're supposed to turn it into a finished document that hopefully the majority of members of the Hare Krishna movement will say, yes, I agree with that. Yes. So, Hare Krishna, don't ask me why I take on such absurd and ridiculous services, because I won't be able to give you any kind of logical or intelligent answer. So when I was looking at this purport today, I thought, well, this is actually very significant, and I don't think anything in the existing paper covers this at all. You know, the existing paper is dealing right now with how do we understand what Srila Prabhupada says and how do we understand the Shastra. But how do we understand empirical evidence when it's quoted by Srila Prabhupada? What do we do with that? Why would we use it? Obviously, there must be a reason to use it if Srila Prabhupada put it in a purport. So we'll take that as a given. We'll take as a given that there is a place for empirical evidence. Yes, can everybody agree with that since Srila Prabhupada put it in a purport? Okay, must be a place for it. So what would be our reason for using empirical evidence? Experimental evidence. What would be our reason? Where would we use it? To whom? For what purposes? So I wanted kind of to discuss this because I realize I should have a section in our paper on this topic. Are you all willing to help me with this? Is that all right? Is everybody cool with that? So I'm going to be more of a facilitator than a teacher here. Is that okay? Have a little bit more like an East Coast? Is that all right? If you don't like that, you can just leave. It's all right. I won't be offended. But I thought we could sort of bring this out. And of course, this is of particular interest to me, myself being an academic and having done a lot of, you know, empirical and academic research. And I've also been thinking about, you know, where is the place of such research and where is the need for such research in our Hare Krishna society. So I think we could start out with why. So I'd like to just ask you, why? What would be the purpose in quoting from empirical research or doing experimental research? Some thoughts. Yes. Do we have a microphone? Because otherwise people listening online aren't going to be able to hear, and I'll have to repeat everybody's things. Okay, if you can do that. So I'll just repeat that for now, but I don't want to have to repeat everybody's. So what Bhadrasain Prabhu was saying was that because it's for a wide audience, that people hearing these far-out statements of life on other planets just from the scriptures might not accept them, but if we quote some scientists saying there's life on other planets, they may be willing to accept them. Is that correct? Might give them more faith. Okay. Some other thoughts about why? Yes. Okay. So You're saying in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, as far as you remember, that Prabhupada references that scientists also say that the heart is the center of the body and the consciousness is carried by the corpuscles or something like that. The energy is carried by the corpuscles. So he refers to something. He doesn't give a direct quote, but he refers to something from modern science. Okay. So any more thoughts on why? Yes. To show the fallacies of modern knowledge. Oh, okay. So by showing a quote from 1960, people would see how that's not stable, how it's changed. So you might quote empirical knowledge to criticize it, basically. To give more faith in a shastra in juxtaposition to empirical knowledge. That because in empirical, I'm just repeating for everybody out there. Because in empirical theories are always changing. And so you giving that as your, okay. Some other thoughts on why? Yes.
The ordinary person just not thinking that they're just...
Make sure you talk right into the mic.
They're not just up in the clouds, like, so they can show that they're not ignorant of other just mundane knowledge or things that are going on in, you know...
Okay, so to show that the author is also connected. I think about that with Prabhupada saying our Gurukul students should learn all different topics so they wouldn't be known as fools. Somebody else with a why. We're going to need somebody running around with the mic. Are you willing to be the runner around with the mic? Okay. Thank you for being kind to the internet people.
I was thinking it could really encourage scientific persons or scholars to feel that they can also contribute in the spirit of Yukta Vairagya. Prabhupada seems to be inviting them in, and that also, yes, your research can be helpful in establishing Krishna consciousness.
Now, that's very much in line with a purport in the first canto. Does anybody have any idea what purport I'm thinking of in the first canto? Just wait a second so we can... Otherwise, I'm going to get all kind of messages later. We couldn't hear what everybody else said, people.
I can't remember exactly where it is, but I remember how it's mentioned that these books are for philosophers, scientists, religionists, leaders of society. So if there's scientific evidence in the books, then yeah, scientists will accept them. If there's religious, shastric evidence, then those kind of people will accept them. So... having all the different kinds of evidences will appeal to all the different kinds of audiences who will read the books.
And the purport I was thinking about from the first canto is where Prabhupada says psychology, chemistry, he lists all these sciences. And he says these can all be used in the service of the Lord, and when they are, they're factually Hari Kirtan. He lists soft sciences and hard sciences. And then he says all of these, when used in the service of the Lord, are factually Hari Kirtan. Any other thoughts about why? Yes.
It appears to me like Prabhupada would give every argument that would support his case, even if whether it was a good argument or not. Like for them not going to the moon, he would say, even if they had go, why not think that the beings there using their technology could make it appear like it was uninhabited? Mm. So then he covers every angle.
Okay. Yes, that's a long way for the mic, if we could.
To some degree, it's autobiographical, because Srila Prabhupada is living in and speaking and addressing and preaching in a particular time. So how it's revealed how he's engaging. We can see when Srila Prabhupada quotes a particular politician or scientist or whatever, then you can see Prabhupada's thinking, so to speak, or how he's preaching. So he's revealing himself by quoting, who he chooses to quote, how he, what the context of the quote is, etc.
That's very interesting. So if I understand what you're saying that Prabhupada's letting us get to know him in that way, letting us have a personal relationship with him. I mean, in terms of biographical, 1960, where was Srila Prabhupada in 1960? Yeah, he was in Vrindavan. And, of course, what was the book that Srila Prabhupada produced in India? Easy Journey to Another Planet, which Prabhupada refers here. And, again, I didn't have time to look it up, but I was wondering if this quote is also there in Easy Journey to Other Planets. I was wondering if he was referencing something that he pulled for that book in here into the Bhagavatam. It seemed kind of likely, since he's, you know, you wonder if he had like a copy of Easy Journey to Other Planets on his desk when he was writing this purport and referred to that quote. Any other thoughts about why? Yes. Just wait for the mic. Sorry.
I just have a question that with the empirical knowledge that Prabhupada's talking about here, is that the same knowledge in the Bhagavad Gita that's that the indirect way? I mean, he talks about two processes of knowledge. One is direct and one is indirect, like you can come to truth after by analyzing things, but it takes a long time.
Oh, that's a very interesting point. So you're asking, is this really like the process of jnana, which brings you to Krishna, but after a very long time?
Yeah, is that related to the...
It would seem so. It would seem so. And that can bring us to our next point, is that what's good about this and what's bad about this? So what is good about experimental knowledge? There must be something good about it. If Prabhupada's quoting it, and if there are places where Srila Prabhupada encourages it, there must be something that's good about it. And what's also dangerous and bad about it? So one thing that's good about it is what you're bringing up, that it can eventually bring you to Krishna, that it's not as direct of a route as hearing from the transcendental authorities. But it will bring you to hear from the transcendental authorities. It will bring you to the point. And we find this, don't we? That people do some scientific knowledge, some experiential knowledge, that then brings them to bhakti. Which is also, it reminds me of a purport in the end of the 12th chapter, where Srila Prabhupada talks about impersonalism. And he says impersonalism may be very useful if you haven't met a pure devotee yet. It may be useful to bring you to the point where you're open to meeting a pure devotee. Or this one gentleman I'm in communication with, who was a teacher of Buddhist meditation, Vipassana meditation, which is voidism. And a very expert meditator, not only a meditator, but a teacher of meditation. And he said in his discipline, their teaching is that there is no teaching, which is always interesting. Our teaching is there's no teaching. Our teaching is that you have to know everything by your own experience. You can't really know anything by hearing from anybody. And the benefit of that is it left them open to experience. You all follow? They weren't locked into any kind of a dogma. And he said one time when he was on an intensive meditation retreat, he had an experience of God. Which is understandable because Krishna says that happiness in the mode of goodness, and this kind of meditation is happiness in the mode of goodness, where Krishna says that happiness in the mode of goodness can awaken you to self-realization. And when he had an experience of God, then he was brought to Srila Prabhupada. You know, so we wouldn't advise that. We don't say to people, you know, go become a Buddhist and do Vipassana meditation because maybe you'll, you know, get lucky and have an experience of God. But it can have some use. So other thoughts on what is the use of experimental knowledge? What is the value of it in Krishna consciousness? Not just why would we quote it to other people, which is what we talked about first. Why would we quote it to other people? But what use does it have? What function does it play? What role can it play in our own society? Yes.
Again, I think because we have different levels of faith in our own movement and we're trying to come to the stage of pure faith, than it might require for neophytes to hear, or lower levels of faith. It will support their moving over to having complete faith in Krishna and Shasta. That was one thought. I don't know.
It's interesting you say that, because I remember in my own Gurukula, so when my oldest son became 14, he started having a lot of scientific doubts in Krishna consciousness. And I consulted with my godbrother Sadaputta Prabhu. I said, what should I do? And he said, well, before you joined the Hare Krishna movement, did you read any books, or were you associated with anything that were about, you know, paranormal activities or things that can't be explained by modern science? And I said, oh yeah, a lot. And he said, well, go out and buy them. So, you know, I went and looked for books of experimental or empirical knowledge that was supportive of Krishna consciousness. And then I developed a whole course called The Vedas in Modern Science. And in that course, I used material not only from the Shastra, but I also used material from experimental knowledge. I mean, for example, it's interesting about Russia, because the Russians were at one time doing a tremendous amount of empirical research into subtle phenomena. I don't know if you're aware of this. They were doing this. You have an idea why? What was their purpose in researching subtle phenomena? Huh? Warfare. Yes, warfare. They wanted to know how they could use psychic abilities and stuff in warfare. Hare Krishna. Of course, in Vedic times they did that, didn't they? They had subtle weapons. Right? They did use subtle powers in warfare. In fact, one of the reasons that the Kshatriyas listened to the Brahmanas was that the Brahmanas had more power materially than the Kshatriyas. This was why Vishvamitra decided to become a Brahmana. Do you all know that? Right? Someone asked about changing their nature. And I said, yeah, you can change your nature like Vishvamitra, but it took him 60,000 years. So Vishvamitra was a Kshatriya. He had a Kshatriya nature. And he went to visit Vasistha. And Vasistha had this Kamadhenu. He had this magical cow who could produce everything. You know, Vishvamitra had come with a whole army. And Vasistha was able to feed and house and, you know, take care of this whole army just from his Kamadhenu. That would be pretty cool, right? Guests come to the temple and you just, your Kamadhenu just provides everything. So Vishvamitra was very envious. There's no other way to put it. He was just very envious, and he said to Vasistha, give me your cow. And Vasistha says, you know, I don't want to give you my cow. And Vishvamitra starts to take her away by force, and the cow cries to Vasistha, please protect me. And he says, I can't do anything. So the cow starts protecting herself. She starts producing armies from the various orifices of her body. And these armies defeated Vishvamitra. And then Vasistha took up his staff. You see where the concepts of wizard with staffs comes from. You know, so he takes up his staff, and his staff had all these mystical weapons, and that completely defeated Vishvamitra's weapons. And so then he decided, I'm going to become a Brahmana. And his motive for wanting to become a Brahmana was power. That he decided the Brahmanas had more power. Of course, once he became a Brahmana, he became situated in Sattvagun, and he wasn't so interested in going around displaying power anymore. But that's another. And then, of course, he became a pure devotee and entered into Ram Leela, Chaitanya Leela, and Krishna Leela. So he exists in all three Leelas as a matchmaker. So that's his rasa. He's one of the matchmakers. But in any case, the Brahmanas had this kind of subtle power. So going back to the Russians. So the Russians were studying this sort of subtle power to use in warfare, and they did all these empirical experiments about telekinesis and telepathy, and I mean, some of them were really ghastly experiments. Like they took baby rabbits and they separated them from the mother, and they put the mother into a submarine, and then they killed the babies one at a time while they were measuring the rabbit's brain and heartbeat, and the rabbit would have a reaction to the killing of her babies on land when she was in a submarine. That was one of their ghastly experiments. And then, of course, you know, Hare Krishna. So I had that book. It was about the Russian experiments. And then in America, in Duke University, a I can't remember the names of the couple. It was a husband and wife team that for many, many years did experiments also in paranormal behaviors. And this was, it was funded by the university, and it was published in journals and so forth and so on. And then after a while, they closed the department, I think, when those professors retired. So we got books like this, and then we got books about physical structures on the earth that can't be explained by modern science. Also, you know, there's buildings in South America, and there's one recent one in Florida that nobody can explain how they were built. That they don't conform to any known method of building, and we don't even have any machinery that could possibly build these structures. And so I got a lot of empirical or experimental books like this exactly for that purpose. Not so much for preaching to other people, but for giving faith even to our own devotees. So other thoughts on what empirical research is useful for? Yes.
It's well known that religious organizations will say that empirical evidence is not valuable and will even contradict. But there's kind of a misconception that the empirical evidence does contradict spiritual knowledge. So Satipata Puru makes the point that actually when it comes down to it, we don't give any importance to the empirical evidence. But when it comes down to it, the empirical evidence does support the Vedic view much more than anything else.
Okay, very nice. So other thoughts on what it's good for? Can we maybe open the door so we get some circulation? Yes.
People have a lot of faith in other people's sense perception and not the Vedas and things like that, so someone's experiential experience, they'll be like, oh, well, you, that was for you. They won't always fully agree with it, but the fact that someone had some experience or did some experiment and got that result, they'll have more faith in that than some old book.
You know, that's even true for full-on Krishna consciousness, that devotees are more enthused by hearing of somebody in the Krishna consciousness movement having some success with Krishna consciousness than they are reading about somebody in a book having success with Krishna consciousness. That's definitely my experience. You know, if you know that somebody in Melbourne is attaining Krishna prema, that gives you much more faith than the fact that somebody in the Chaitanya Charitamrita is attaining Krishna prema. Yes.
I thought humility, thinking of the pastime of Kamsa and Vasudev. Vasudev glorified Kamsa, so he appreciated and validated what he was saying to calm him. And then he got an outcome. Devaki wasn't to be killed.
Can you explain that a little bit more?
It's sort of the heart of a devotee. Comes from a place of humility. They encourage the demonic appreciation and use of sense perception. I'm almost there. It's just hard to explain.
Okay, I'm trying to understand what point you're making because it sounds really interesting. So that because devotees are humble, they're willing to encourage even people who are demoniac in a way that will help them come to Krishna.
Yeah, like a shift in consciousness, like using the consciousness.
Using the consciousness where they're at to help them shift their consciousness.
Yes.
Would there be any value to us doing empirical research? What would be the positive value for devotees engaging in empirical research? Yeah. Wait for the mic.
Perhaps looking at giving an individual focusness, researching a specific topic, and obviously that focusness will lead towards Krishna eventually.
Okay.
Yeah, some form of attention.
Where so they're focusing their interest.
Yeah, in your research. and it can also distract you from every other material desires one may have when doing the research. So
right.
That sounds beneficial.
Yes, over here. Just wait. Otherwise, I'll definitely get messages. You know, we couldn't hear her.
To increase our faith.
To increase our own personal faith.
Our own personal faith.
It helps people to relate to topics that they have experienced or they grew up learning, so that they're more open to accept the Shastra.
What kind of things do you think we might want to do research about? If we have, you know, devotees who have the ability and the background that they could do research, what kind of topics do you think we might want to research? To do experimental, empirical research, not Shastric research, but experimental, empirical research. What kind of things do you think we might want to research?
Some guy in the 70s did research on the effects of chanting Hare Krishna.
The effects of chanting Hare Krishna.
And reincarnation. There's huge studies.
Okay.
Establish the science of the soul. Prabhupada would try to present in many, many different perspectives. And that's always ongoing.
By the way, did Srila Prabhupada establish something in ISKCON for this purpose? What's it called? The Bhaktivedanta Institute. And Srila Prabhupada established that specifically for the purpose of preaching to scientists and preaching in a scientific way using research. Who did he ask to do empirical scientific research? Swarup Damodar especially. He asked him specifically. Go and do scientific research. So what are the topics what we research?
Krishnendu online has a comment.
Hmm?
Krishnendu has a comment from online.
Oh, you got a comment from online. I hope it's not, I can't hear the...
if Shastric is unclear, we can look to empiric evidence for guidance.
And by the way, we do that. That is regularly done even by our leaders. Any other thoughts on what we could be researching? I mean, if Prabhupada says that that having all these hard and soft sciences is factually Harikata, he says that in the first canto. Yes, in the back. Wait for the mic.
Drudhakama and Sataputta, they did their research on archaeological verification or refutation of their claims. So that's one area that empirical source of knowledge is important to show on the same terms as the scientists that claim in the contrary, that actually we're prepared to take them
on their own terms.
On their own terms, yes.
Well, if the archaeological evidence that Drudhakarma Prabhu has been researching is about human origins mostly. So, you know, Sataputta and Drudhakarma researched from archaeological and paleontological evidence that human beings are very ancient. And Drudhakarma Prabhu is also now doing archaeological, along with one of his disciples from Hungary, that they're doing research on ancient sites of Krishna's pastimes. And finding archaeological evidence for that. Okay, other areas that we could do empirical research. Yes, all the way over here.
The transformation of food into prasadam.
The transformation of food into prasadam. Wow. That would be very interesting. I don't think anybody's done that. Yes.
On that note, there's been experiments done with taking like a couple of glasses of water, and so they put, over a week or something like that, they'll give that glass all the love
Yeah, the effects on of consciousness and language on water. Should I say something really funny? There was one Gurukula that had the kids do that experiment where, you know, they were insulting one glass of water and they were praising the other glass. And being children, they got much more into the insult glass than the praising glass. So they talked to the insult glass more. I think they had plants also. They had water and they had plants. And so they were... The children gave most of their energy to the plants and the water that they were insulting because they're children. And so those actually thrived just because they got more attention. That even negative attention is better than no attention. That was the results of their empirical experiment. Reminded me how Krishna and the cowherd boys, they would insult the animals and they would insult into the wells, right? They would yell insults into the wells. Hear the echo. So that was an interesting replication of that experiment. Any other thoughts on what we could do research about that would be service?
The research into the previous life and previous yugas, the book that Devamrita Maharaj wrote, Searching for Vedic India, is such a wonderful eye-opener, which shows us that there was so much life right back to the beginning of time, and it's being proved now, the previous civilizations.
Okay, excellent. Some other thoughts? So I did empirical research about job satisfaction of teachers in Hare Krishna schools. What makes the teachers in the Hare Krishna schools happy in their service and what makes them not happy in their service? Because I'm a social scientist, I'm not a hard scientist. So that kind of social research is also, I find, would be very helpful in our Hare Krishna movement, especially since devotees tend to throw out, everybody tends to throw out numbers that they grab from the sky. And what I've realized is that when people want to make a strong case and they want to sound authoritative, they will often try to cite empirical research, and if there isn't any empirical research, they make it up. So, you know, people will say, we have such and such divorce rate, and it's like, well, where's your study of the devotees that you're coming up with this number? You understand what I'm saying? And there isn't any such study. It doesn't exist. There's no research like this. Like in the study I did of teachers in Hare Krishna schools, I asked how many people were divorced or widowed, and it was a total of 2%. And I surveyed every single teacher in every single Hare Krishna school. This was in 2005. And of those who were either divorced or widowed, how many got married for a second time? And that was only 1.7%. So that's a very low, and that was divorced or widowed. So that's a very, very low percentage. And I thought, you know, sometimes people just pull numbers out of the sky. And that if we're going to have good leadership in our Hare Krishna movement, it would behoove us to know what people are doing and what people are thinking. Otherwise, we just guess. So this was, we did a little bit of empirical research at the Otaki Festival when, I think probably very few of you were there. We had an open Q&A session, Jaishila and Vimala and myself, with people about family life. And then we asked people to write down what are your greatest doubts in regard to family life, what's your greatest challenges, and what's your question. And then Vimal and I took those and we spent an hour and a half compiling the answers and analyzing the answers, the questions rather, that we got, putting them into different categories. And then the next day we came and we tried to answer as many of those questions. We put them into categories, and each of us took a different topic to speak on in response to those questions. So that's a kind of empirical research. And we found out that people had doubts and challenges of which we weren't aware. And so as a preacher, it's a very wise thing to do to at least occasionally, at least once or twice a year, to anonymously survey the people you're preaching to. Otherwise, you may be preaching about something that happened a long time ago. And somebody brought this up, actually, in our seminar yesterday about training children in Krishna consciousness. And they said, it seems to me that such and such leader is addressing things that were true, is addressing now things that were true 20 years ago and are no longer true. And so often empirical research is useful to find out what are people's current needs, what are people's current situations, what are people's current concerns. Because although in one sense these things are eternal, everybody's concerned with eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, and their false ego and things like that, the specific ways in which they manifest will change radically over time as the social situation changes. And not only research of interviewing people, but research at looking at what are people talking about on local media, for example. You know, what are people chatting about? What's in the magazines? What are the topics that people are discussing in the world? And if you don't do that kind of research, it's very hard to preach effectively. So I was asked by the strategic planning team several years ago to put together a seminar on what's called environmental scanning, which has nothing to do with ecology whatsoever. But it's where you do regular empirical research into what's going on in your environment. What's going on in ISKCON, what's going on among Gaudiya Vaishnavas, what's going on among Vaishnavas, what's going on among Hindus, what's going on about, you know, Eastern spiritualists, what's going on in religions, what's going on in the world, you know, in ever-increasing circles. And that way you can best serve the devotees and you can also best preach to the outsiders. And I think, you know, we have often a big problem that there's a disconnect, right, between what somebody's preaching and what somebody's presenting and what people are actually experiencing. So I see that this is a very good use of empirical research. And that is a kind of empirical research. Even if you take surveys of your guests, you know, not every Sunday, but some the kind of thing where you, how did you, what did you think about the food? What did you think about the temperature in the room? I mean, I was in a temple once where I told the temple president, I said, you have a real problem with temperature and airflow in your temple room. So that is, especially in the summer, it's just stifling hot and people can't breathe even. And so it's hard for people to stay and listen to the class. And he didn't believe me. He just said, I'm not having a problem. And then finally somebody donated an aircon system for the temple room. When the temple president announced that at the Sunday feast, he said, you know, we have a donation of an air conditioning system. People were throwing flowers and shouting and practically jumping up and down, you know. And he walked up to me and he said, you were right. I'm like, okay. So, you know, some kind of feedback, and you'll notice that many companies do this, yes? You know, you'll take a flight and then you'll get something in your email. Please fill out this survey. By the way, do that because they pay a lot of attention to those things. So this is another form of empirical research, getting feedback from people as to what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong. Any other kind of empirical research? Yeah.
That you, I was out of the room, so you may have said it, but I think it's also good that leaders themselves get feedback.
Yes.
They're willing to humbly do empirical, sensitive research on their own leadership, and I think that's something that's...
That's something that's being started now in the GBC and something that I've been personally involved with the GBC. So ways of doing empirical research on yourself, ways of self-evaluation. And we did this in Otaki in terms of sadhana. We had it was kind of a holistic self-evaluation. What is your life going on in general? Do you have a life in general that is supportive of doing daily sadhana? So we can do that kind of empirical research. Okay, so last thing I want to look at is, what are the dangers of empirical research? What are the things we should be careful of with empirical research? Yes?
It can and will contradict the Siddhanta.
That it can and will contradict Siddhanta. So instead of giving you faith in the Siddhanta, it can harm your faith in Siddhanta. Okay. Yes?
Become a distraction from your own Krishna consciousness. Easily get too far into it.
Get too far. We've seen that, by the way. Yes.
Krishna was referring about the jnanis, how they can take lifetime to do research. Eventually understanding Krishna himself.
Okay. So that if that's our main method for understanding Krishna, if we become jnanis instead of bhaktas, then we're really delaying our... We may get there eventually, but it won't be a very delayed process. And not a very pleasant one. Also, Krishna says not a pleasant process. Some other thoughts on the dangers of empirical research, either doing it or relying on it. Yes.
I'm just thinking in a general sense, there could be a danger of sort of pride developing. Devotees feeling, are we really understanding all the nuts and bolts? And I might become a little bit puffed up.
Mm. And it could even be, you know, I know better than the Shastra because I've gone out and done research. Some other thoughts on the dangers?
It could project confusion to people. As in your own bhakti you're not sure of, so you need to extend outwards to find out reasons why you are following the path that you are.
Interesting. Any other thoughts on the dangers? Yes.
Empirical research doesn't explain the phenomena of consciousness and the gradations of consciousness. So simply relying on that can breed familiarity and offense.
Mm. Which would be a warning. You have to know what the limits of it are. You have to know what it can't, what information it can't give you.
And also a point you made a couple of days ago in my place about when chanting, you mentioned how chanting is based on mercy. If you try to analyze, you can't really get Krishna's mercy.
Yes, they can put you in that mood of not understanding it's a personal process that's based on mercy.
You may have to associate with non-devotees in order to conduct such research or study the subject matter.
We found this to be particularly a problem with people who get into topics of research that are very, very close to Gaudiya Vaishnavism. So I haven't seen this a problem so much when people research something that's out there. But when they start researching, you know, Gaudiya Vaishnavism, it can breed all kinds of doubts. But it can happen with the other way too. You know, you can start, because of the association of non-devotees, you can start taking on their mentality and you can start looking at what they're doing as being supreme and doubting. Another big problem with empirical research, let's go over the big problems with empirical research. You never see the whole picture, but you might think you see the whole picture. You know, and this is the essence of this verse, that nobody sees the whole picture except Krishna. So you never see the whole picture. And empirical research is always clouded by an individual bias and a cultural bias. Always. You never have empirical research unaffected by both individual bias and cultural bias. The way of trying to get free of that is to have a lot of people replicate the studies. But we were talking about this at the Gurukul. The problem with replication is that the peer research journals very rarely publish research that is simply repeating somebody else's research. They usually publish just the original research and not the repeats. But it's only if you do a lot of repeats by a lot of different people that you're really going to find out if it's valid. And so often things are touted as being correct, and after other people test it, they find out that it's not. But by that time, you know, they've done all these things. They've made all these changes in society based on the initial research. Then another problem with empirical research is there's an unlimited number of stories about the same set of facts. And we see this in our human relations, that we get in arguments with people where we each say that something different happened when we were at the same place in the same time and experienced the same thing. And this is the problem with crime. You know, the police go to a crime scene and there's a set of facts, but you can make a whole bunch of different stories about those facts. And so wrong people end up getting imprisoned, or if you ever read, you know, detective novels or something, where they give you the facts and you jump to a wrong conclusion. Because your conclusion fits the facts, but many different conclusions can fit the facts. Another problem with empiricism is you never know what you don't know. You never know what you don't know. Because you don't know how many instances there are out there altogether. So let's say that you do an experiment, you know, with 1,500 instances of a particular phenomenon. And even if 100% of your experiments yield the same result, you don't know how many instances of that phenomena exist altogether. So you have no idea what fraction of the whole you're looking at. Does everybody understand what I'm saying? You may only be looking at 1% of the whole. So even if you're 1%, and this is one of the big problems why replication often, if you have an experiment that's repeated enough, the results start disappearing. Because in most experiments, you take just you're just looking at a percentage. You know, instead of interviewing all the people who, you know, drink apple juice, you interview 200 people who drink apple juice, and you extrapolate from that 200 to the whole. But you don't know what the whole is. Does everybody understand this? Yes? So you don't know. Maybe you just happened to experiment with the 1,500 instances that are all like that, and maybe none of the others are like that. Do you know until Europeans came to Australia, they thought all swans were white? This is one of the prime examples given in the textbooks. And then in Australia, they found black swans. You know, but you don't know they exist. And this comes to the problem of other planets. That even if we could possibly look at all the instances of something on this planet, do we know that those laws of science operate the same on other planets? You don't know. And you don't know what you don't know. So you're saying, all you can really say is, in all the instances that we have observed and all the instances that we have experimented, this is not false. That's as far as you can go, and you simply can't go any further than that. And then your instruments for your experimental knowledge are defective. Your senses are defective, and your instruments are made by defective senses and can only amplify your defective senses, and you're using the instruments with defective senses. So, again, that's a case of not knowing what you don't know. You're not necessarily aware of what you can't hear and what you can't see, and therefore you're not really able to take all the information into account. And then these theories are always changing. People ask me this at the Gurukul, you know, should we never punish or reward any kid? And I said, well, that's a current theory, but there were other theories and there'll be new theories. And it's just a theory. It's not Guru Sadhu Shastra, and therefore you can't make it this is absolutely true that you should never punish or reward anybody. And Krishna punishes and rewards people. So obviously he thinks there's some merit to it. So there's these constant changing theories, and we need to be very careful with empirical research that we don't get attached to any theory about anything as truth. Because, you know, what's considered truth at one point in human history will be considered untruth maybe 5 years later. You know, the very things that people are seeing, this is the truth, this is real, this is the direction we should go in, will be completely contradicted sometimes. You know, they'll just go the opposite way. And so if we base our life wholly and solely on these kind of things, you know, we may end up to be disappointed. But I wanted to start off with the positive rather than start off with the negative, because I think many times in the Hare Krishna movement, we just see the negative. We just say, oh, all empirical research is bad. But if all empirical research was bad, Srila Prabhupada wouldn't have quoted it in his purport. He wouldn't have established the Bhaktivedanta Institute. He wouldn't have said it's also Hare Katha. So this is an instance where things are not in just some black and white category. You know, like little children tend to see the world as very black and white. This is all good and this is all bad. But reality is not like that. And there are many things that have a place in service, that we can use in service, but we have to know what is their place and where we can use them and where we don't use them. Now, ultimately, if we want to find out truth, interestingly enough, what is our ultimate proof of truth? For each of us as an individual, what is our ultimate truth? That I am not this body, that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. What is our ultimate proof? Pratyaksha. Rajavidya Rajaguryam Pavitram Idamudamam Pratyaksha Vagamam Dharmam Susukam Kartamam. Our ultimate proof is our own experience. Isn't that interesting? What's ultimately going to convince us of these things? That we experience them. And therefore, Srila Prabhupada would say, you don't ask somebody else, how advanced am I in Krishna consciousness? Like you don't ask somebody else, did I eat enough food? That it's something you have to experience for yourself. He says, nobody gives a certificate to somebody else. You know, that's not. He said, that's not how you judge advancement. You get it, you know, here you have it, your Uttama Bhakta certificate. He says, he says this many times. Yes, am I correct? You do not get a certificate from others. He said, in the same way you don't ask somebody, have I eaten enough? Am I satisfied? Am I nourished? You know yourself by your own experience. And will we ever know everything about Krishna? Never. By the way, I'm sorry, I tricked all of you, but even Krishna doesn't know everything about Krishna. I asked you who knows everything, and you all said Krishna. But he doesn't. Because Krishna is always expanding. He's dynamic. So Prabhupada says Krishna expands and then his knowledge of himself expands, then he expands. So his expansion is always ahead of his knowledge about himself. Do we all like finding out new things about ourselves? Does everybody like that? Yes? It's one of our most exciting things, by the way. We may not want to admit that, but one of the most exciting things for us is finding out something new about ourselves. And Prabhupada says in Krishna book that Krishna has all the propensities and inclinations of a human being. So Krishna always likes finding out new things about himself, and therefore he's always discovering new things about himself, and even his expansion and Anantasesha with all of his unlimited heads is never able to fully explain everything about Krishna. And that's when Krishna talks about that we relish and rejoice in the self in the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. He also relishes and rejoices in himself. And one of the ways he relishes and rejoices in himself is that he's always learning new things about himself. So our goal is not to know everything in that sense, because that's not possible. Our goal is to know enough and be convinced enough that we fall in love with Krishna and that we attain the supreme goal of life. But we do not have any kind of a goal that we're somehow, whether it's through Shabda or whether it's through Pratyaksha or Anuman, that we're going to come to some point that now I know everything. That is not going to happen. But we will certainly understand everything. So I hope that this was interesting. Hope you didn't mind that we had a different format. But when I saw that in the purport, I'm like, let's take a look at that aspect of things. So thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.